Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Hallie Tecco. The use of psychedelic medicine has steadily moved from the fringes to more mainstream use in the treatment of mental health conditions, and I have so many questions. Today's guest is an expert in this area, Dr. Ali Sharma, the co-founder and chief medical officer at Being Health. Dr. Sharma is a board-certified psychiatrist who received her medical degree at Cornell University. Dr. Sharma, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Hallie. I'm so privileged to be here with you and excited for this conversation.
I do have so many questions. So ketamine therapy recently made headlines as Prince Harry wrote in his memoir, Spare, about taking ketamine to help him deal with his mother's death. Can you just lay the groundwork of what is ketamine infusion therapy and how is it being used today?
Thank you so much. So I've spent the last 2 years doing my due diligence and researching this area and specifically looking at the therapeutic applications of ketamine in a mental health setting. And so to take a step back, you know, the 2 years of work led to me co-founding this practice that we have called Being Health. And one of our offerings, novel treatments, we call them, is ketamine infusion therapy. And what is that? So let's kind of, I'm going to give you like the bird's eye overview and then we can drill down. So ketamine has been around since the 1970s. It is an anesthetic medicine. So if you take your child to the ER, they might receive ketamine. If you have a surgery, you might receive ketamine. And ketamine has many other uses. So we also know that it's a drug of abuse. It's used for pain syndromes. And it's also used for depression. So ketamine, you know, just to break it down in terms of what it does, we don't know the exact pathophysiology. However, ketamine is an NMDA antagonist. It works on something we call the glutamate pathway. And that's where we get the rapid antidepressant effects. It also works on neuroplasticity. So it helps to change the brain and the circuitry. And ketamine, you know, through different studies and research, we've seen that it's really great for treating something that we call treatment-resistant depression. So what is that? So depression is episodic. So what does that mean? It means that at a certain time in our life, with a certain confluence of events, psychosocial stressors, life events, transitions, a person may experience depression, and that's called an episode, that period of time that it happens. And, you know, the first-line treatment, if we're talking about pharmacology, medications, are antidepressant medications. And if a person has failed at least 2 trials of medications and there hasn't been a good effect and an alleviation of the symptoms of depression, that's considered treatment-resistant depression.
And how often does that happen when the first line of treatment doesn't work or the first 2 lines of treatment don't work?
Sure. So of people who have major depressive disorder, about a third actually have treatment-resistant depression. And the other thing to know is that antidepressants, they do work. Like, I'm a clinician, I see patients over the years, and in clinical practice, there are a majority of people that respond to antidepressants, about 2/3. But then there's that other third where it doesn't work. And the wonderful thing about ketamine as a novel treatment for depression is that it gives us one more tool in our toolkit for those who really are still struggling with symptoms of depression.
Okay. And then, but you, would you not recommend it to folks who perhaps the first line of Prozac does work, but they just want to try something different?
No, actually, we really follow the evidence on this, that we would try medications first. And, you know, just to take a step back, if we're talking about the treatment of depression, there's actually so many things that you can do before you even get to the medication phase. You know, I think the first, just to talk about this, because I think this is really important. You know, the first thing is self-care. Now, if what do I mean by that? So if someone has treatment-resistant depression, they're already symptomatic, they're already severe, but self-care is still a very important part of how you think about taking care of yourself within the constraints of what you're experiencing. You know, so that could be focusing on your sleep, making sure you're getting sleep, even if that requires the help of a licensed medical doctor or another provider. It could be thinking about nutrition and what you put in your body, thinking about reducing alcohol or and or drug use, thinking about your daily routines and what could enhance, you know, the possibility of feeling better. So self-care is a whole area that people can work on themselves. But we, you know, there's other really great treatments for depression, including psychotherapy, and which we might offer depending on severity of symptoms. But when it's treatment-resistant depression and someone has tried everything and has had a couple of medication trials that haven't worked, that's really when ketamine could be a possibility.
And what does a psychedelic-assisted therapy session like a ketamine therapy look like from the patient's perspective? What sort of preparation goes into it? What is the session like? And what sort of follow-up support is involved?
Sure. So that is a really good question. So I'm just going to walk you through our protocol, and then I can talk about it like very concretely. So in our protocol, the first step is to have a 75-minute consultation with a licensed board-certified clinical psychiatrist. So what that means is they think about psychiatric risk, substance use risk, as well as medical risk, and really think about safety first. So that happens. And let's say someone passes that first step and perhaps labs are ordered or not. The next step is what we call CAP preparation. So that's ketamine-assisted psychotherapy preparation session. So in our protocols, this is a session that is not with ketamine as part of it. So it is before we ever do an infusion. It is with a CAP-assisted psychotherapist who has special training. And this session is really about preparing the person for this infusion. So a lot of that might be orientation of like what to expect, what's going to happen, what do you need to do the night before, et cetera. And the other really important piece of this is exploring the psychological aspects of the person that they're working on related to what's making them feel depressed, what's making them feel down, as well as setting an intention before the infusion. So that's about an hour session. And we recommend at least one with our ketamine-assisted psychotherapist, but people can opt for multiple to prepare.
And then, it's the same person that's there the day of the session.
So in our protocol right now, the way it works, it's a big team of people that really help to help the person through this process. So the day of the infusion, a CRNA, which is a certified registered nurse anesthetist, is the person who administers and monitors the infusion. There's always someone in the room with the person during the infusion who's a member of the care team. Right now, we have the luxury of having just started our startup, so our therapists are able to be in the room. However, it may be a medical assistant or some other member of the care team in the room. And then our integration sessions, we recommend within 24 hours of the infusion. And we can do that remotely or in person. And that, again, is outside of the infusion. And it really is a processing of what came up during the ketamine session. So And I'll give you a flavor to this, just clinically or anecdotally, because everyone is different in how they respond and what their experience is. But it ranges from kind of just mellowing out and dissociation and coming out of it feeling a lot better, right? Like feeling less depressed and feeling good within 1 to 2 hours, to people actually having experiences of either past trauma and memories coming up. And what I see in some people is sometimes memories of like really wonderful things come up that they haven't had access to. And there's this, people have described to me, I feel this comfort. I've reconnected in this session with a side of myself when I was really happy. And I realized it's not so far away, you know? That statement has been said to me repeatedly. And we could give you so many other examples, but those are two that stand out to me as really interesting to observe.
Is the actual session guided? Is there a conversation that the provider follows to walk someone through and bring out these emotions and memories?
I'm so glad you asked that question because this is a very interesting part of our ketamine infusion therapy session. So when someone walks in the room, first of all, it's a very comfortable chair and an environment that they're in because set and setting is really important. It can influence and make or break an experience. We give people a very comfortable eye mask. They can have a blanket, weighted or a light one. And the really wonderful thing is that we are collaborating with a company called Wave Paths. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but no. I met them at, there's a conference called ICPR in the Netherlands, which is a research conference on psychedelics. And they are a company founded by a neuroscientist and a PhD, oh, sorry, and a musician, a PhD neuroscientist and a musician. And they have tested music and have evidence for the music that's appropriate for specific psychedelic therapies. And so we use their platform. And so a person who's in our ketamine infusion room will have headphones on and will hear music. And we can tailor it based on intensity or the type of music they want. We can also change it within the session if it's too intense. They can also remove their headphones and listen to it just in like in the room. And so the music actually helps to assist their experience. They can also opt out of it too, but it's called Wave Paths. And, you know, we had been following them over the last 2 years and decided to, to institute that into our programming.
And could they listen to the music later on and kind of bring back memories of the experience?
Yes. So they get a recorded session of the music that happened within the session and they can re-listen and revisit.
And what does it feel like to have the ketamine infusion? Like, are you able to hold a conversation, or is it a very visual experience?
Yeah, sure. So ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic. So think about if you've had surgery, right? And you go under, you're completely knocked out. Okay. Yes. This is like a very, very small, like sub-anesthetic dose. And so think of it as a, for lack of a better way to describe it, kind of feeling a little like very out of it. So you go into this like hazy state, and often it's a state of relaxation and people lay back and you have this music. So you're conscious, but you're also then experiencing other things at the same time. So a little bit out of it. And, you know, it's what we call an altered state of consciousness.
Okay. It sounds like I've been under anesthesia, and coming out of anesthesia was kind of similar to what you just described of being a little out of it. I remember I had a female surgeon and I was like, "Mama Bear, you took such good care of me." And I was like saying funny things in the moment. I felt I had very big feelings, but was, you know, just kind of out of it.
Oh, exactly. And that coming back to the present, which is something that anesthesiologists do all the time, that's a really important process for us too. We make sure the person feels safe. There's someone in the room, and you know, that can take, we build in an hour for the person to like come back to a healthy state of consciousness afterwards.
Can you go back to work? Can you drive a car? Like, what can you do and not do after a session?
Yeah. So definitely not drive a car until the next day. We really recommend for people not to do work the same day. It's, you know, think about it. If you're in a surgery, you have surgery the same day and you probably recall you feel a little bit out of it that day.
Oh yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And also like if you've been going through depression, And let's say something comes up in the session, like it's really good just to have space and downtime to process it, to sit with it, to journal. And we really encourage people to like write down and capture, well, what happened in the session? What am I feeling? What am I going through? And that's part of the therapeutic process.
Yeah. So what do the studies say about the effectiveness of ketamine therapy for depression?
Sure. So I'll tell you three different statistics, which I think are interesting. And if you need the citations later, we can get them to you. So basically the first thing is that 70% of patients experience a rapid reduction in depression symptoms. So it's different from traditional antidepressants like SSRIs or SNRIs, which take 2 to 4 weeks to start working, right? So you can literally feel better, a rapid reduction. And then the response time is significant. So patients feel better within 1 to 2 hours of ketamine administration. Wow. And then the other thing is that there is durability of ketamine's antidepressant effects. So meaning like, okay, you might feel better in 1 to 2 hours, but does it stay? You know, and if you follow the protocols, the general durability of ketamine's antidepressant response is 60% at 8 weeks.
Wow. So other thinking about SSRIs, which you're taking on a daily basis, if you were using a ketamine therapy, you could come every 6 to 8 weeks instead?
So I'll tell you the treatment protocol. So yeah. It's called an induction series. And let's say someone has never had ketamine before. They've had their trials of antidepressants. It hasn't worked. What we would do and what the research shows is most effective, we would do 2 infusions a week for 3 weeks and possibly 4 weeks. But generally, it's 6 infusions across a 3-week period. And that's what usually optimizes that potential for that durability of response.
Okay.
And then after that, at Being Health, we have a way to track symptoms and follow up and check in with people. People can also come for monthly drop-in groups, integration groups. And if there is a resurgence of symptoms, it's based on clinical need, then people can come in for a maintenance infusion. And that's really variable across like people in terms of the frequency that they might need for maintenance.
Yeah. We'll be right back after the break.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So what if a patient had success with an SSRI, but would rather not deal with taking a daily pill or deal with some of the side effects of it? Could this be an alternative to them, or is it really strictly only for those that have not had the first line hasn't been effective?
So at Being Health, we are following strict protocols and really looking at the best of the evidence. And so we would follow our protocols, which means it really has to fall into the category of treatment-resistant depression. And just so you know, we also have 2 other diagnostic categories that we include. One is treatment-resistant anxiety, where it's concurrent with the treatment-resistant depression. And then the third is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, where there is also a significant mood component and treatment-resistant depression.
Got it. And are health plans covering this? I imagine no. I imagine they're just saying it's cheaper to get some Prozac. I don't care.
Well, that's a really good question. So ketamine infusion therapy, they are not covering. We're using it off-label, like all of the providers in the U.S. are using it off-label for depression. However, there is something called esketamine, which is like, it's also called Spravato. You might have heard of it. It is a specific molecule. It's called an enantiomer, but it is actually FDA approved for depression. And it is an intranasal form. It's called esketamine. It's not the same molecule as ketamine. That is FDA approved. And that is accepted by some insurance plans. And when we're not yet in network, but when we are planning to go in network, we hope to be able to provide Spravato just to increase access and make it more affordable for people.
Sure. Okay, so beyond ketamine, we also hear about MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, and I looked it up. And in fact, there are 30 psychedelic treatments currently in phase 2 and phase 3 trials with the FDA. So just kind of to understand the full world and to orient ourselves in the full world of psychedelic medicine, where are we in terms of ketamine? Obviously has been leading in terms of research and acceptance. What else is kind of on the docket for us?
Sure. So this is really exciting for us in our field. Although a lot of these new psychedelics that are coming on the market with therapeutic applications, you know, some of them have also historically been drugs of abuse. It's really exciting to see these potential therapeutic applications. So I'll just highlight 2 and then I'll go through some others that are coming. So the one that you mentioned, MDMA, is really exciting because they've been studying MDMA in clinical trials for PTSD, and it's gone through phase 1, 2, 3 of the FDA process, and it's currently under review. And we are watching that one because that's the first one that's really we're poising ourselves to be ready for. So that's really exciting. And then the other 2 that we've been watching are psilocybin for depression and LSD for therapy. So there's something at the FDA called breakthrough therapy designation. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but basically. So basically it's a process.
Yeah. Explain for our listeners.
Yeah, sure. So that designation of something being a breakthrough therapy, it's a process at the FDA. If something's labeled that, then the development and review of drugs can be expedited. And it's usually in conjunction with treating a serious condition where the actual treatment at hand that they're testing is like shows substantial improvement for the person and maybe a clear advantage over available treatments. And so that's really exciting because there are a lot of clinical trials in different phases looking at psilocybin for depression and treatment-resistant depression. And also LSD is now a breakthrough therapy for anxiety. And that is in phase two right now, but hopefully that gets expedited. But just to give you a couple of other examples, which I find so important, in phase three, there's a clinical trial that looks at ketamine as a treatment for alcohol use disorder. Other examples, there's a trial that looks at psilocybin for alcohol use disorder, ketamine for PTSD, psilocybin for OCD, psilocybin for generalized anxiety disorder, psilocybin for anorexia. I mean, I could name a lot, but just to give you a sense. And I just want to tell you one thing that I learned at ICPR, which is that conference in the Netherlands I was mentioning happened 2 years ago. There is even really exciting developments from these top researchers. And this is like outside of the United States, even looking at, for example, LSD for dementia. And we got to see the preliminary results and case studies of, you know, like someone who's older in their 80s, who really had difficult symptoms of dementia. And after treatment with LSD was showing like a change, a cognitive change. So these are really exciting and we're really watching what's going on. And you're right. There's like actually across all phases of drug development, there's like 50 plus clinical trials right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting because I feel like the research could have been 40, 30 years ago, but there's so much stigma around them. Because as you said, these are also street drugs that have been abused in the past. And so there's like a stigma that comes with it. How has that impacted the research? And do you think we would be further along if we didn't have so much stigma tied to it?
So that's really interesting. I think the first thing is there were certain regulatory authorities in the 1970s that actually banned, I don't know if you know this, but banned the research on psychedelics for a long time, you know, and there's been a lot of advocacy in the last 5 to 10 years to change that. And that's slowly changing, right? And, you know, for example, in our protocols, if there's a risk of, you know, something triggering addiction, we're not going to do that, you know, unless there's significant evidence that it could treat the addiction, right, later down the road with these clinical trials. So we are very careful in the way we've developed our protocols. And the other thing to note is that we've really done it in conjunction with, like, it was a partnership between anesthesiology experts and psychiatry experts. And I think that should be the gold standard if we're thinking about ketamine infusion therapy, because you're really then having the mental health expertise and the infusion and medical management expertise together. Yeah. You know, it could be other physicians as well, like ED docs or other physicians, but that really, like, safety is really important, you know? And I think, you know, we have a rigorous safety protocol. And like, I think that should be the gold standard. And I think regulations are going to change to ensure that this is the case. It's just that right now we're in the beginning of this where, you know, I think a lot of clinics are just trying to figure out how to do this.
It's so interesting that, as you said, it had been banned, research on it had been banned. So we have these substances that have been around and used by people for many decades illegally. And yet we only have more recently started to do the research to understand the benefits.
So let's talk about the stigma for a second. So I hear what you're saying, you know, because of this lack of research for so many years on psychedelics, plus the fact that these psychedelics have been medications of abuse, let's say, or with the potential for abuse, it has been hard probably for the medical community to adopt the idea of these new treatments. However, for me as a clinician and a person who really relies on science, when the evidence is clear, the evidence is clear. And I have to tell you, because I've been to a lot of these conferences now on psychedelic research, and it really is interesting because when I think about my frame of why I was at these conferences to develop novel treatments in our clinic, for example, you know, my frame was like, I am interested in the therapeutic applications of these drugs. And there were other subsets of people who you know, who really would talk and very open about them using the medications and firsthand experiencing the benefits of it. And there were other people who were users and then became researchers, and this became their life mission to prove and to provide evidence and to have us understand these medications better. And there were other people who were maybe in the private sector and business and financiers and want to make money out of this. So it was really interesting, like cross-section of society that was there. But for me, it really is about the therapeutic applications. And I think why we created Being Health and integrated novel treatments is we really want to think about, like, in our field, what is tried and tested and what we do with what is novel and emerging, because that's really how we're going to help people, right? Yeah. Not everyone responds to X, Y, and Z treatment. Some people, and some, not everyone will respond to ketamine either. You know, there is no one-size-fits-all approach. And I think, you know, if we can diversify the types of medications we have at hand to help people, that's amazing. Like, these are the new frontiers in mental health.
And to be clear to listeners, Being Health is general mental health care, and psychedelic medical treatment is one piece of what you do, but you also have other options. Do you want to talk about other, you mentioned acupuncture, other ways to treat mental health disorders?
Sure. So we have created at Being Health a modern mental health practice that is what we're calling an integrated care model. So it's many different types of services under one roof, the tried and true with the new and novel, with a high degree of provider collaboration across disciplines and really like personalized care. And we offer five different service lines. So first is psychiatry, then psychotherapy, then novel treatment. So our first is ketamine infusion therapy. We also offer functional medicine, so deep dive, root causes of what's going on with your health and mental health. And then we have wellness services. And our two that we're starting with are nutrition with a functional medicine lens and acupuncture.
And before this, you were, you've worked at large provider organizations. Why did you decide that you wanted to start a completely new practice?
That's a really good question. You know, I've been working as an attending psychiatrist, you know, clinically, for example, in the ER or in student healthcare services or the homeless population. And I shifted to systems level work. I worked globally integrating mental health and primary care or running a city program in mental health. I worked in health tech for a while. And I think through all of my experiences, especially even my outpatient practice that I've had since 2008 and still run, I just always found that, again, human beings are complex and everyone needs something different. And my scope as a psychiatrist, I have a wide scope, but it's limited in terms of what people need. And I was often referring people to this and that, or even lifestyle things like, okay, you need to think about how you dress. Like, think about, you know, some sort of service where, you know, you can get help there. I mean, there, you really think about the whole person, mind and body and lifestyle and the ecosystem in which they live. And I was like, you know, and I always thought about this even 20 years ago, how can we create a clinic that is soothing, healing, multidisciplinary, that kind of gives people the chance to do a lot of different things under one roof, but where you have a care team that is talking to each other, right? Because the challenge in, at least in my practice as a private practitioner, or even other clinics I've worked in, is you can refer someone to something, but you don't know if they'll go. And even if they go, it costs administrative time to coordinate. And so, you know, based on all the experiences working across cultures, working across types of modalities, this idea came up, you know, also in the context of these emerging and novel treatments. And, you know, I definitely have had a wellness focus for myself and self-care, you know, and just like thinking about lifestyle. So it all came together and we really worked for almost a year and a half to build out this clinical model. And that's how it happened. I would say it's not where I expected to be. This was not like the specific intention.
Yeah.
But this is where I am now.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, one last question, just going back to psychedelics. Tell us about how we can combat the persisting stigma around evidence-backed psychedelic medical treatment to ensure equitable access for anyone who might benefit.
Absolutely. Look, so I think, I mean, it's why we're doing this podcast, for example. I think the first step is raising awareness. And it is about education, but with a specific emphasis on science and the evidence. And I think I do agree that, you know, these things in the press that come up, sure, they can cause a lot of alarm, but I think the response then is really important. Like what we're doing now, you've asked me two questions about the things that are public, but just grounding it in science. You know, I think that's the first step. And then I think maybe the second step is, you know, for example, if we can be a model in terms of the rigor of our protocols for how we think is like the gold standard of care to administer ketamine infusion therapy and help people replicate that, you know, and I'm sure there are other clinics doing this as well, but I feel like our protocol is special in the way that it was designed. That would be amazing too, you know, and I've thought about that, like how do you scale that concept or that idea? And that's why we really want to talk more about what we're doing and educate the public.
Amazing. Well, Dr. Sharma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Hallie. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Heart of Healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. The Heart of Healthcare is produced by Hallie Tecco. The show is engineered, edited, and mixed by Kyle Moore. Visit our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com, for show notes and episode details.